Welcome to the Functional Tennis Podcast. I'm guest host David O'Hare. On today's episode, I'm joined by Brad Stein, current coach of Tommy Paul. We chat through and talk about the art of coaching, the importance of trust and building good relationships, and how to stay curious when it comes to professional coaching. Enjoy the episode. Well, Brad, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Functional Tennis Podcast. For those of you that are unaware of Brad's plethora of accomplishments within the sport, Brad currently coaching Tommy Paul. As we record this, he is playing in semifinals tomorrow against Medvedev in Indian Wells. To name a few other top players that Brad has worked with, Kevin Anderson, Sebastian Grosjean, Jim Courier, to name a few. So really a wealth of knowledge, as well as maybe touching on almost every aspect of professional and amateur tennis, with running your own academy back in Fresno to being a USTA developmental coach, so on and so forth. So very fortunate to have such expertise join us and join me. So thank you very much for accepting this invite, I suppose.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, I'm well aware of the podcast. You know, Functional Tennis, I think, has a pretty good spot out there in the tennis world, you know. So and the fact that you're picking up a little slack for the guys and everything, you know, and we know each other so well, I was really happy that you asked me to do it. I feel honored to be on.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, I have to say, you know, you were definitely a big part of me kind of getting back on the tour many years ago, just post COVID, aligning me with Mitch Krueger, and that was kind of really, yeah, reinvigorated my kind of coaching career, I suppose. So I definitely, yeah, I owe you more. But yeah, so I guess we do know each other quite well, and I've been fortunate to have you as somewhat of a mentor. We work quite closely when I was traveling with Mitch, and you're kind of consulting as well a little bit remotely, and also kind of when schedules aligned and there's a bit of overlap. So yeah, hopefully we can share some of your philosophies, coaching philosophies. I certainly enjoyed kind of the times we shared lunch together and a couple of phone calls and many exchanges of texts of me kind of as a somewhat inadequate coach to some top players. So yeah, you really helped kind of calm the nerves and the imposter syndrome that I maybe initially felt on my first experiences on the tour.
Imposter syndrome. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's funny because I think those of us who didn't necessarily have successful playing careers, I think that sometimes we're a bit driven by that conflict between being here at this level and coaching the best players in the world and not necessarily having played at that level. You know, you're a much better player than I ever was. And the fact that you've gotten to compete in Davis Cup and you know, you did play for a while on the tour before you had the injury, and kind of, I mean, I think you were a little bit forced before you wanted to be to be a coach, but you know, there's it's a common thing, I think, amongst the guys that didn't play, you know, coaching great players and not having been a great player yourself is an interesting concept within itself.
For sure. Yeah. And I think you know, I think we're still fortunate to be able to play. And for me, you know, I was talking to Freddie Nielsen there the other day, saying how much of an advantage it is to actually still be able to compete and not fully lose touch. And this is something that we've talked about on some of our early morning hits. Wherever we are in the world, we generally try and get out there together. And it really is, I mean, it's obviously elevated once you're kind of in the match environment. So I'm not so sure how many times you get to play matches throughout the year. But I think that's really helped me to try and kind of empathize with the guys that I'm coaching. And I'd be interested to hear, just over the successful career that you had, you know, again, what are the touch points, the lessons learned, be it from successes or failures, and what's made you one of the most kind of outstanding coaches of the last, I mean, how many years have you been on tour?
Man, I mean, I started full time on tour traveling in 1991.
Wow,
long time ago. Yeah, that was my first full year. I coached prior to that, more on a part time basis with the USTA. My first original time with the USTA, and I was working primarily with the guys in the futures, and I was traveling more in the summer and everything. But I started full time. Started with Courier at the end of 1990, the off season of 1990, and then we started traveling full time starting in 1991. So I was very fortunate, a little bit lucky for sure that Jim Courier was my first full time gig on the tour. But that went back to the fact that I'd been coaching with the U.S. Junior National Team, which back in those days we called the Junior Davis Cup team, and Jim had been a part of that program, and so I met him when he was about 15 years old, and we connected pretty well, and we kind of stayed in communication with each other throughout the years until he turned pro, which wasn't too much longer. I mean, he turned pro at about 17 and a half. So, but he actually came through and played an event where I lived. That was an exhibition event that he played where I lived, and we went out to dinner and hung out a little bit. So it just kind of, when he was looking to make a change at the end of 1990 in his coaching situation, he actually contacted Jose Higueras and through the USTA again. And Jose didn't want to and wasn't interested really in traveling a lot at the time. And so they were looking for someone to do basically what you and I did with Mitch Krueger, where Jose was kind of the lead coach and I was the traveling coach. And you know, that put me in an environment that was a really, really special environment. Jose, I mean, I think to this day, he's one of the absolute most amazing minds that's been around tennis for a long, long, long time. And that gave me an opportunity to kind of mentor under him. And then to be on the road on a day-to-day basis with Jim, you know, was a phenomenal experience and just helped me grow so much in those circumstances. And so that was kind of my inroads into the game. Really, it started with that Junior Davis Cup team. A legend of collegiate tennis, Greg Patton, asked me to be his assistant coach for the Junior Davis Cup team. And I actually said no originally. We had about an hour-long conversation on the phone, and I said no because I was still playing a fair amount at that time. I was about 26 years old. And I was taking graduate classes, had finished my play, obviously, in the collegiate level. But I was playing in the summers, every summer in France. Would go over and I'd play money tournaments in France and just was kind of being a tennis bum in a way, you know, but having a blast, meeting a ton of people, you know, and that was such a fun experience for me. And I felt like I was kind of going to do it one more year and then I was probably going to stop. So when Greg called me, I'd already bought an airline ticket to go to France. And I basically told him that I, you know, wasn't going to do the job. And he called me back the next day and we had another hour and a half long conversation. And he pressed me and, you know, asked me what I wanted to do, ultimately what I felt like my long-term objective was and what my career was going to be involved in. And I said, I think I'd like to be a coach. And he said, well, if you're going to be a coach, this is the single most important decision you'll ever make in your life. And he was absolutely correct, because that job with the USTA and Junior Davis Cup put me in touch with that full generation of players on that team. We had Sampras, Michael Chang, Todd Martin, Malavia Washington, Jim Courier, David
Quite the
Wheaton,
lineup.
Yes, it was every player that then became a top 100 player, a top 10 player, a number one player from the U.S., except for Andre. Andre Agassi was the only guy that wasn't a part of that team. He had basically already turned pro, so he wasn't on that team. But, you know, that gave me an opportunity to develop relationships with all of those guys. And that's what translated into Jim then asking me to travel with him later on. So, you know, I have Greg Patton really to thank for that opportunity. And it put me in an echelon of high performance coaching that I had never experienced really. And so that was another amazing opportunity. You know, I considered Greg to be one of my, you know, I think of myself really as having had four really, really important mentors in my coaching career. And Greg was kind of number two in the lineup. And I feel like I learned different things in different environments from each of those. I like to think that I'm continuing to learn. I think one of the reasons that I'm still being successful on the tour after so many years is because I have a pretty open mind about learning things, certain things. There's certain things that I'm very you know, committed to in my coaching also, but that, you know, have developed over the years. But yeah, Greg was a guy that I really learned that the tennis itself obviously is the most unbelievably important aspect of becoming a player, but I really learned that attitude and conduct were things that I would not, they wouldn't be non-negotiable for me. A player's attitude and his conduct on the court, I think, are key elements. And I saw that through Greg, because he was really, because we were coaching the national team players and these guys were representing the United States as junior players and we were traveling all over the country at that time. ITFs weren't as big back then, so you didn't really travel that much internationally. But we had a huge junior circuit here in the U.S. and that's where all those guys played. And Greg demanded a level of conduct and attitude from those guys that was, you know, at the pinnacle of where he wanted everybody to be, because they were representing the country. And he just wouldn't give in on that ever, you know, and he didn't let a guy get away with you know, any kind of a bad attitude, bad language on the court or throwing a racket or doing any of that was just not acceptable. And he would get into guys about that and he never hesitated to do it. And I definitely learned a lesson from that, that was something that I felt was important. And I carried that into my collegiate coaching, because that first summer that I worked with him, I also then got the job coaching at Fresno State, you know, and I coached 5 years as a head coach in Division I collegiate tennis. So it all kind of like snowballed and started with all of that, you know.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I suppose that leads us into a nice little segue now. How do you think, you know, do current juniors, obviously you kind of have been around at a few events, and attitude is maybe not necessarily one thing that most coaches prioritize these days. And is that, obviously you still hold those quite true to your philosophy and your coaching mentality. And, but how has the game changed? How has your approach changed through the years? You know, obviously working, and not even that, you know, relationships change, but also the team, the dynamic of having bigger teams. And does that fall under your umbrella role as head coach, making sure everyone's kind of singing off the same hymn sheet and all kind of swimming in the same current and working together for, let's say, obviously for Tommy's performance, which seems to be going quite well for you guys, but how much of a lead do you take on that with regards to, yeah, Franco's S&C and making sure it's as tennis specific as possible? Or, I'd be interested to hear if you find the roles have changed to when you first got out there to compared to nowadays.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll answer the first part of that, because I think it's an important aspect of that, you know, is junior tennis. It's funny, you know, as you go down in levels, you go, if you go down to the challenger level, you go from the challenger down to the future level, you go from the futures to the collegiate level, you go from the collegiate level to the junior level. I think you see conduct get worse and worse and worse as the levels drop. I'm not sure why it is, but coaches don't seem to be as willing to hold players accountable to their conduct as they get to a lower level. I think players think that that's the way you're supposed to act, and they see sometimes, you know, the guys at this level doing that, the top guys, and so they think that maybe that they think that that's part of the passion of being involved in it. But I think at the lower levels, especially, you know, you go watch futures and you see some absolutely insane stuff that happens on the court with guys, you know, and then they wonder why they're not progressing as well as they should be. But obviously, you know, the mental aspects of the game are such an important part, and that's where the conduct and the attitude comes in. It's not just, you know, asking people to be choir boys on the court. That's not what it's about. It's about, you know, controlling your emotions, controlling your mental focus and state while you're out there to allow yourself to perform and play your best tennis. And that's where the conduct and the attitude, you know, it crosses over with being part of being a better tennis player. And so I'm a big believer in that. And that's why I demand that from the guys as much as anything, you know, so that I think it's going to help the guys be better tennis players. You know, I think it's hard for parents. I think it's hard for junior coaches. Sometimes they see short term way too much, and they don't see the long term enough. You know, as far as the second part of the question with our team, you know, I feel very, very, very lucky to be involved with the team that we have. We have a phenomenal team, and it's come together over the course of the time that I've been with Tommy. You know, you mentioned Franco. Franco Herrero is Tommy's strength and conditioning coach. We have Sebas Kozorin, who's Tommy's physio. And then we, a little bit behind the scenes, you know, I think he deserves a lot more credit than he gets. We have Hugo Armando, who was a good player on the tour, got to, I think, around 65 or 70 in the world on the tour. I don't know what his career high was. I'm sorry, Hugo, a few higher than that. Hugo's just an awesome guy and a very, very, very good coach. And for people that don't know, I live in California and Tommy lives in Florida and trains in Florida most of the time. And so I go back there some, you know, but I don't go back there all the time. I actually do think it's important to have a little separation between player and coach at sometimes because we, you know, we spend so much time together on the road. So Hugo fills in and is on the court every day with Tommy when Tommy's back in Florida and I'm not there. And then when I am there, a lot of times Hugo and I'll be on the court together. And so at the end of any trip or when things are going on, I'll contact Hugo and go over what I felt like, you know, are certain aspects of things that Tommy needs to focus on for the next week or two in practice until we hit the road again and go to a tournament. And so Hugo is just a massive part of our team. But I feel like overall, this team, more than probably just about any other team I've ever been involved with, we just have a very symbiotic relationship. Everybody gets along. Everybody's on the same page. Communication level is very, very easy. And I think the guy that is the most significant in all of that, like you mentioned, is Franco, because Franco has been so good from the start. You know, I do have certain philosophies about footwork and movement on the court. And, you know, Franco, when we first started, was teaching a few different things and things that I didn't necessarily agree with or want to have involved in our development. And he was very, very open to listening and to you know, accepting the information that I was presenting to him about how I want to see Tommy moving and do, you know, on any given ball. And so really now pretty much I would say 99.9% of what Franco does when he's doing movement type stuff, you know, that's on court, simulating on court movement, is based around, you know, my footwork philosophy. And so that makes an enormous difference. I would have a hard time personally working with a strength and conditioning coach that didn't do that footwork and was encouraging or training the footwork in different ways. And Hugo, again, very first conversation I ever had with Hugo, you know, I brought up some of the footwork stuff and we were on the same page right from the beginning. So that was a huge relief for me as well, you know, because that I think that's such a big aspect of everything. And, you know, because you and I did it, you know, and you know what I'm talking about with the footwork in relationship to being involved with Mitch. And, you know, it's tough if guys had different aspects of that. And you feel like from a coaching standpoint, what, you know, whether it was Hugo or whether it was you with Mitch, if you're disagreeing with what I'm saying, but you want to keep the job, then the tendency is that you're kind of undermining, you know, what I might be including in what's going on. And that becomes a really unhealthy situation. So we're really happy with our whole team and with how they are.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's not like Tommy moves that well, so there's still definitely massive room to grow for you and the team in that department. No, obviously one of the best movers on the tour. So yeah, credit to you and the team for continuing to sharpen those knives. And yeah, I mean, he's certainly a joy to watch when he's in full flow out in court. But that brings back, I suppose, with all the amazing kind of player-coach relationships that you've developed through the years, you know, developing trust and reassuring the players is such a key part of any relationship, I suppose. But how have you managed to establish such trust and camaraderie with your players over the course of the years to have such successful relationships and partnerships with them?
Yeah, it's funny, we were kind of commenting about this a couple of days ago with some of the guys. We were just sitting around, you know, and And I think the bottom line, Dave, is that you can't bullshit men's tennis players. You can't really bullshit men's athletes, you know, male athletes. You know, if they think what you're telling them or what you're asking them to do isn't going to help them develop and be a better player, they're going to call you out on it at some point, sooner or later. And so I think one of the things, you know, going back to your other questions before, one of the things that I did from an early period, I'll tell you a quick story. When I first got hired, I first found out that I had the job at Fresno State. You know, I was 26 years old. At the time, I was the youngest head coach in Division I tennis in the United States. And I was at the U.S. Open with the Junior Davis Cup team when I found out, you know, and I remember literally spending two full days probably mulling it over in my head, like, okay, now I'm a head coach of this program. Like, what am I going to do to set myself apart from everybody else? I got to come up with something that's, you know, it's the Brad Stein philosophy. Like, what is it? You know, something special that'll set me apart. And I kind of, you know, I kept racking my brain of, you know, what's it going to be? How am I going to be, like, you know, what's going to be unique to me? And it hit me while I was going through this whole process, you know, thinking about this, it hit me in my head that it doesn't matter what sport we talk about, you know, whether we're talking about American football or basketball or soccer or whatever it is, the teams that generally perform the best and the teams that win championships generally are the teams that are fundamentally the most sound. And I just kind of slapped myself in the face and was like, I don't need to find something unique and special. I need to be the best there is at teaching the fundamentals of the game. And I really, my entire coaching career, I've been on a quest to be the best that I can possibly be at teaching the fundamentals of the game. And that includes, you know, the footwork, the stroke mechanics, of every stroke, basically of every stroke. I feel pretty confident about being able to teach any player at any level the fundamentals of a forehand, a backhand slice, transition plays, how you make those, getting to the net and volleying, the movement that's involved with all those different aspects, serving, returning. And I'm constantly, constantly, constantly looking at it, you know, in every player that I watch. In some ways, it's a curse because when I watch tennis, which I watch a ton of tennis, you know, when I'm at home, you know, and I get up and I make my cup of tea in the morning, the first thing I do is turn on Tennis Channel, especially if there's matches in Europe. You know, if there's matches in Europe for me in California, it's perfect. I'm up at 7:30 in the morning, turn on the TV, and I'm watching matches from Europe. It's great, you know. But my tendency in watching those matches is to nitpick about, you know, guys' footwork, about guys' mechanics, about things that are going on. And sometimes it ruins just enjoying the matches, you know. It's like, yeah.
Do you have some sort of a method, I suppose, or do you try and embrace people's, I suppose, genetic makeup or athletic makeup and apply principles to their movement or to their strokes? Do you, like, embrace their uniqueness in that way, and or do you try and cultivate, you know, somewhat of a cookie cutter mentality, you know, the forehand? Like, are you rigid when it comes to elements of a stroke? I imagine footwork, you're probably pretty rigid, but then embracing people's natural forehand, let's say, but yeah, embracing principles as opposed to modeling it on a set forehand that you have in your mind's eye, you know, where do you fall on that scale, and where's the balance there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually. You know, I'd like to think that one of the reasons I've been successful over the years is because I'm not rigid, because you have to be able to take, you know, I mean, obviously Jim Courier had very unique strokes and stroke mechanics. You know, look at, I went from working with Jim to working with Marty Fish, you know, much different type of player. Sebastian Grosjean, I worked with Taylor Dent, you know, and obviously much different player than all the rest of those guys. I think what you said is exactly right for me. The footwork, I don't like the term rigid, but I am pretty set in how I want to see guys moving to any given ball. That being said, I don't try and make that happen instantaneously. I I'm I'm uh I like to say that I'm a bit of a cajoler as a coach. You know, it's a day-to-day process of kind of pushing your guy in the right direction. Sometimes it can go very quickly. Sometimes it can take a little bit more time to get guys to find that kind of movement. The footwork, I am definitely a little bit more established in how I want to see things happen with the footwork. The stroke mechanics are, I think, very individualistic. You know, whether you set the racket higher or you set the racket lower, depending on what your grip is, you know, and we work with, you know, I'm not sure exactly where you are, but in general, you know, I work primarily with guys and girls that I've worked with over the years that have pretty established stroke mechanics. Have we changed some of their stroke mechanics? Absolutely. In the course of my time with Tommy, we very, very much changed his unit turn on his forehand side. He had a big flying elbow, you know, on the forehand. He took the racket back and turned, and the elbow was the first thing that went out. The racket head kind of faced down almost to the ground, and then he did what I call the dog wagging its tail, because the racket head would be late and then catch up, and he could hit the crud out of the ball like that, but it was so whippy, and there was just, he would lose control of the racket head all the time, and there was a lot of room for error in that swing, you know. Yeah. And he still has a bit of, you know, what we call the cobra, the wrist, you know, a little cocked as he takes it back, you know. And you know, for people that don't know, I'm also coaching Ethan Quinn, who's now, you know, rising in the rankings a little bit. He played here at Indian Wells and got a wild card in the qualifying and won two rounds in qualifying, got into the main draw, which was great for him. He's up to about 250 in the world now after he's been on tour for less than a year. But I mean, Ethan also has a big cobra on the forehand. I'm not a massive fan of the cobra. Yeah. You know, that's just developed over the course of time. And at this point, I ask Ethan, especially because Ethan's younger. Tommy's forehand is much more established now. But Ethan's, you know, I'll ask him just to try and reduce the amount of the cobra a little bit, just make it a little bit more, firm and flowing through the forehand side. Then Ethan's cobra is bigger than Tommy's is. And, you know, if I had never seen Ethan Quinn play and I came and watched him play, I would look at it and go like, man, I don't love that on the forehand side, you know, but he's got a massive forehand. And at this point, you know, we're not really gonna change that very much. So it just depends a little bit. And I think that's part of being a good coach. You know, you can't look at players and try and make them into the exact same cookie cutter-ish type ball striker that every single other person that you have in your own mind and your vision, you know, the way you would think they wanna hit it. So it's tough sometimes with that. But again, like, you know, it's funny. I go back to, like, I coached Andrei Medvedev back in the olden days for a while, you know, when the guy was, I started with him when he was ranked four or five in the world. And his take back on the backhand, his hands immediately went down. He dropped the racket head and then turned, you know, to set the racket after that. And like, he had a phenomenal backhand, you know. Are you going to change that? Like, no chance. Do I love it? Do I think that's the best way that you can possibly hit a backhand? No, I don't. You know, but you would never change that with a guy who's enjoying that kind of success. And his backhand was, you know, probably almost his better side.
Very interesting. Very interesting. No, I totally agree. I think you have to embrace people's idiosyncrasies. I think it's one of the old golf coaches, maybe our players, Gary Player or something. And I think is he quoted saying swing your swing or anyway, but I think that applies in tennis as well. You know, I think there's such an emphasis on technique. I mean, again, I'm speaking broadly, but I feel like when I was a junior growing up, technique was everything. And I feel like there should have been bit more in actually like understanding the game, in competing well and what that looked like, as opposed to, okay, yes, great technique and mechanics, albeit quite hard to achieve on a slick Astro court in rainy Dublin. As much as that is important, I think other skills would have probably served me a little bit better. And I think, yeah, it's for the coach that I want to be going forward. You know, I think, you know, I've not had the the pleasure of working with many kind of juniors yet, but I think that's something that I would aspire to do in developing player. You know, I know the backstory with the relationship between yourself and Ethan and local boy from Fresno, and you've had a lot of input into his career. So it must be hugely gratifying to see him excel and crack, obviously amazing collegiate career at Georgia, and now, you know, as you say, inside the top 250, and he's not stopping there. I don't think he's got a fantastic game, and yeah, it must be, you know, that must be a really special feeling, as much as you've kind of been incorporated and kind of developed players and taken them to new highs. Talk us through actually the emotional journey of developing a player and then still seeing him succeed and still be kind of consulting on the side. That must be fantastic.
I feel like it's kind of full circle for my career, to be honest with you. You know, I think that Ethan will probably be the last guy that I coach, assuming that Tommy and I stay together for a while longer, which I, and Tommy, it's interesting, before I answer the rest of that question, you know, I was thinking recently that, you know, I coached Jim Courier for a total of about 7.5 years, almost 8 years. But there was a split in the middle. We worked together for about 4 years, and then we stopped for about a year and a half, 2 years, and then we got back together, and I coached him again until the end of his career, until he retired. You know, Jim retired pretty early. But I was thinking that Tommy is actually the longest continuous guy I've ever coached at the tour level. That we're in our fifth year now, and that's the longest I've ever been with anyone. You know, and it's funny because when I was first on tour with Jim, and I was with Jim for 4 years, and then I stopped with Jim. I'm the one who actually stopped. I stopped to work with Andre Medvedev. Andre kind of came to me and made me an offer, and I was still working with Jose Higueras at the time, and I wanted to kind of be in charge of the whole situation. I wanted to kind of, like, you know, see if I was capable.
Establish
really
yourself.
Of,
yeah.
Yes, exactly. You know, because I'd always kind of been under Jose's wing, and I felt I wasn't leaving Jim, you know, just abandoning him because he had Jose, and so that opportunity presented itself, and I took that, you know, and that put me on my own, and then kind of led to where I'm at now, you know. But yeah, with Tommy, I'm actually I realized after being with Jim, stopping with Jim, I was only with Medvedev for even less than a year, about 10 months, 11 months, and we split up. He fired me, my first firing on the tour level, you know, and so I was pretty devastated at the time. In a way, I flew home. I actually flew to Australia, met with him. He fired me and I flew back. And the only good thing about that was that he paid me for the rest of our contract, which was through the rest of that year. So I had a pretty large check in my pocket when I was going home. But, you know, at the same time, I got home and I got a phone call like literally 2 days later from Marcelo Rios's coach. And he asked me if I was interested in working with Marcelo. And I kind of turned that down, you know, because he wanted me to fly someplace and meet with Marcelo right there. And I was like, man, I just don't want to do that right now. And I thought, I remember hanging up the phone and thinking, well, I'm not going to have trouble finding a job. I mean, look, I got a call 2 days after I got fired. Well, about 10 months later, I still was not employed on the tour, you know, and I was working at a club. A buddy of mine, you know, was just said, hey, come and help me in my junior development program. So I was feeding balls to, you know, like 12-year-olds and thinking to myself, what the heck am I doing out here every day, you know? So that was, but I also came to the realization, that, you know, 4 years in a row with a player on the tour, like I had done with Jim, was a pretty good stint for the tour. You know, we do see some relationships that last really, really long on the tour, and those are phenomenal. And I have so much respect for people that do that. But in general, I would say the majority of relationships on the tour between coaches and players are probably more in the 2 to 3 year period, you know, somewhere. And then coaches, players are looking, especially players that are ranked a little bit lower. I think the players that are higher, that enjoy winning more, they tend to stay with their coaches, you know, more. But you know, Dave, everybody knows that's involved with the game, that there's a lot of guys on tour that actually end up, you know, having very good careers. They play in the top 100 for the vast majority of their careers for years and years and years, and they end up with, if they're lucky, you know, a 50% win rate. Sometimes guys even stay in the top 100 and they have lower than a 50% win rate. And so, you know, if you're ranked from 30 to 100 or 150 or 200, you're not winning as much as you certainly would like to be winning. And I think players often look at that situation and then feel that they have to make some type of a change because they think they can be winning more. And the change is generally the coach. And so staying in a relationship now with Tommy and being here for 5 years, you know, I feel lucky and blessed really to be involved with him. Tommy's a very loyal guy, you know, in doing that. So 5 years with Tommy is pretty good. But Ethan Quinn, I've been coaching for a little over 13 years now. So we really started our association when he was about 6 years old. And that's back when I was doing my little academy that I had in Fresno for a while. And Ethan was one of the kids that started out in the academy. You know, one of the things that's interesting about Ethan is that he's had two private lessons in his entire life that you would describe as actually being a lesson, you know, where he paid for an hour-long lesson with someone. One was with me when he was in the academy, and one was with the head pro at the club that we're both members at one time. And everything else he's ever done was either in the academy or then as he started to get better and I stopped the academy, whenever I would come back to Fresno, I would just hit with Ethan. You know, he was 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, starting to be better and better. To be honest with you, when I started hitting with him, as much as anything, it was more for me just to get some exercise. You know, I knew he was a gym rat.
The selfish exploits of a coach.
Yeah, he's 100%. He always wanted to hit balls, you know? And so I knew I could always call Ethan if I was looking for a hit and just be like, you know, hey, he lives right around the corner from our club. I live a mile away. I was like, hey, let's meet at the club in like 15 minutes, go hit some balls. And he would always be like, oh, great, let's do it, you know? And so typical of me, we hit and I couldn't help but coach him a little bit. And so then I started coaching him more and more and more, you know, and funny story. I think I've told you this one before, Dave, but you know, I hit with him from the time he was, you know, just like that. Cause the academy ended when Ethan was about 10. So I probably started hitting with him again on a very regular basis when he was about 11 or so. And I never charged him, never charged his parents a dime. So I would just, you know, and part of that was because I literally was thinking like, this is kind of my exercise. You just go and get a workout in on the court, you know, have some fun. It's like low stress. I can beat the kid every single time. He's 11 years old, you know, come on.
Yeah.
Felt
happy
good.
Days.
You know? It didn't really
big
feel
confidence
that
good. Boost.
Didn't really feel that good. I'm beating up on an 11-year-old, you know, but no. So, you know, he's 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. And, you know, when I would go home, it started to get to the point where I hit with Ethan almost every day that I was home. You know, so, and I would hit with him for an hour and a half to 2 hours. And it was more of a workout than a lesson, but we would constantly talk about technique and mechanics. And as you could see his development, then we started talking about competing. And I absolutely 100% agree with you. We would start doing drills that were based on simulating point play, you know, and whether I'm hitting from a corner or whatever it is, and where do you play this ball and how do you play this ball to try and, you know, expose the other guy and or highlight what you're doing well within your game. And so a lot of it was talking about competing and you know, seeing Ethan develop. And one of the things that I'm a big believer in when you work with juniors, and if you asked Ethan, he would tell you this, that he didn't have a ton of success in the early age groups, in the 10s, 12s, and 14s, because I talked to him right away, even when he was, you know, a young kid, about the fact that our objective and our goal was to get him to play men's tennis as quickly and early as he was possibly capable of, because that's the end goal. Your goal is not to be a great player in the 12s or 14s. Your goal is to be the best player you can be when you're 16, 17, 18. And now that game is going to be the basis for your ability to become a really good collegiate player and or hopefully down the road a pro. And so that was always our objective, you know. And Ethan actually talked about collegiate tennis more than I did. I talked more about, like, you know, men's tennis to me translated to like, let's try and play pro tennis. You know, as soon as you're able, you're gonna move and start trying to play a few futures and a few, you know, we're lucky in California to have an opportunity to be able to do those things. So yeah, watching him progress through all those, and it's funny, when he was down here, we were having the conversation a little bit that You know, Ethan did kind of burst onto the scene a little bit when he was 17. He had been doing pretty well in some of the national events and was getting a little bit of attention. And he got a wild card into this tournament, a junior tournament that was being held in San Diego that's called Spring Nationals here, which is it's an ITF event. And he gets a wild card into the tournament. At the time, he was ranked like 440, 460 or something like that in the ITF. And he wins the tournament. And he beat, I think he beat three top 10 players in the tournament and wins the tournament. And then the following week, right after, he stays there. And at the exact same site, they had the Easter Bowl, which is a big tournament here for North America. So it's an ITF still, just but it's domestic. Only for North American players. Yes. And he made the final. So he went win and final of those two events. And his ranking went to like 70 in the world, or 60 or 70 in the world. And then he did well again in some other ITFs that he got into. Because at that point, it was like, okay, you're 20 spots, probably 30 spots from being into the Grand Slams. And so he did well again, and he made the French Open and Wimbledon and played all the slams after that. And that was where he was really like, all of a sudden, everybody knew him. You know, and that was actually in 2021, because in 2020, during COVID, you know, we had a 5 or 6 or 7 month period where there was nothing to play. And Ethan and I were literally climbing over the fence at our club and hitting in the club. And it's kind of interesting because our club is a member owned club. So everybody has a little piece of the club. And I talked to an attorney who's a good friend of mine that's a member of the club. And I said, hey, can we get arrested for being in the club when the club is closed? And he was like, I mean, it's a member owned club, right?
Technically,
that means you own the club.
Yeah.
So technically, can you be trespassing on the property that you actually own? And I was like, oh, that's a good argument. I like that.
Yes.
You know, so we were climbing over the fence. Yeah, exactly. We weren't the only ones doing it. Trust me. So we would see other people there sometimes. But yeah, you know, we spent a lot of time working and training on that. And that was one of the things that, you know, when Ethan came back, his game had progressed quite a bit. Because that gave us that period during COVID where I was really seeing him on a day-to-day basis, because I wasn't working with, I was still coaching Tommy, but I wasn't really working with Tommy during that period, you know, because of COVID. So it gave us an opportunity to help develop his game. And like you said, I mean, you know, Tommy said it, it's so ironic. This is a crazy thing. I don't know if you know this or not, Dave, maybe you do, but you know, Ethan's first tour level match was at Newport, Rhode Island, the grass court event there, ATP 250, and he plays Tommy Paul.
No way.
He plays Tommy Paul in his first ever match, and I wasn't there. I didn't go to Newport. I wasn't there, so I'm watching the match on TV, listening to the commentators, everything. And Ethan had gotten he won. I take that back. It wasn't his first, because he won a round in the main draw. He won one round to play Tommy. So it wasn't his first ever. It was his first tournament.
Yeah,
and he played Tommy, which was so ironic, you know. And Tommy said after the match, because the on-court interview, he was asked about it. He said, you know, I know Brad really cares about me and he cares about my game and he wants to see me doing my best. But he said Ethan is basically his next son. So I know he was probably pulling for Ethan in that match, which wasn't necessarily true. You know, I thought Tommy should definitely win and did win the match, you know, and it was just a great experience for Ethan. But he always pulls that joke out, you know, that I care more about Ethan than I do about him.
That's hilarious. All right. Well, I don't want to keep you too much longer. I've definitely got one or two more questions. Firstly, bring it right back. You know, it's clear. Amazing passion for the game. Where has that passion come from? You know, you talk about not being able to switch off and just watch. You're it's so ingrained in you to analyze and to coach and to seek to better people or so. Where is the passion, the love for the game? Where has that stemmed from?
Yeah, I think it goes back as much as anything to the fact that I wasn't as good a player as I wanted to be, you know, and despite that, I love competing. I'm a pretty competitive person. I always have been, you know, in everything that I do. And, you know, coaching is a form of competing. It allows us to continue to compete to some degree or another, you know, I always felt like from a coaching standpoint, and like I said, you know, I started coaching at the collegiate level when I was 26 years old. So I was very young when I got into the coaching. You know, I was a halfway decent player. I played collegiately, played some good tennis on and off different times. You know, I always like to think that I'm a halfway decent, or at least I was a halfway decent ball striker. You just led me into, I don't mean to segue again too much, but, you know, I look at guys out there like you that are, you know, still hitting the ball really well, and they can go out on the court and hit the ball with their players all the time and stuff. And I don't hit as much with Tommy as I used to. I hit more with Ethan. When I'm home, I still hit with Ethan, and Ethan hits a massive ball. I actually surprise myself sometimes. Like, I'm actually hitting the ball pretty good, and this guy's pummeling forehands at me. But I've always enjoyed getting on the court. I've always enjoyed hitting balls. You know, you've gotten me out quite a bit over the last couple of years to hit balls, and I really, really enjoy it. I enjoy the challenge of just trying to hit the ball as well as you can, even if you're not keeping score. But I, you know, as a player, obviously just didn't reach the heights that I wanted to reach. You know, I had aspirations of trying to play pro tennis, and I played a little bit back in the old days, what we called satellite before Futures came into existence, you know. So, and I had a sponsor for a short period of time, didn't do particularly well early on. He was shocked at how much it was going to cost, and kind of backed out relatively early. And I didn't have a lot of money. My parents didn't have a lot of money. So that's what led me to actually go to France and start playing the money tournaments in France. The first year I went to France, we had played a satellite in Switzerland, but we started in France with a couple of money tournaments just to get our feet wet, and then went to a satellite in Switzerland. And so I kind of knew the French system a little bit. And the next year I went back, and like I said, I was taking some graduate classes, but the next year I bought a one-way airline ticket and took all the money I had in my bank account and put it in my pocket to go to France. And I said, I'm either going to play well enough to buy a ticket and come back, or I'm going to stay in France for a while. Because all the money I had in my pocket was about $150. And wow, okay. We're talking back in the early 80s. So, you know, it was probably the equivalent of $500, but $500, yeah. You know, I was there for the entire summer for about 3 or 4 months, you know, while I was playing. And I did pretty well. I did pretty well, actually. I won a few tournaments, and I probably made 12 or 14 grand that summer, you know, and spent some of it while I was there traveling around and having a good time. And then, you know, bought a ticket, and I came back with probably $8,000 or $9,000 in my pocket, which for me was like, I felt like I was a millionaire, you know? So it was, that passion's always been there from that standpoint. And when I had the opportunity, and like I said, going back to Greg Patton, getting me into that environment with the top juniors and the absolute best juniors that were in the country, and then that translating to be on the pro tour, you know, when you're sitting there watching your boys play doubles, it gets your heart going, you know, and you get pounding, you get pumping with what's going on. We just had, you know, like you said, this is going to be a little further down the road, but Tommy played quarterfinals of Indian Wells yesterday and played Casper Ruud, and it was a tough 3-set battle. And I mean, I'm sweating bullets at the end of the match, you know, trying to look calm for Tommy when he's looking over at me and everything. But man, you feel it, you know, you're competing, you want to see your guy win that match, and you feel it inside. And that adrenaline rush that you get even just sitting in the stands watching the match is still something that I think we all really appreciate from being out here.
It's exhilarating.
It's absolutely exhilarating, even as a coach. And when you're away from the tour for a while, you know, you miss it. And you, as a coach, or I think, you know, obviously as a player, you know, when your time is done and you're retiring, you know, that those are the things that you miss, is that sense of exhilaration and also the camaraderie amongst the guys on your team and all that. And it's a special environment, you know, and it's a little bit addictive, you know. Sometimes, you know this for sure, Dave, you know, being with Mitch, it doesn't always pay the best. You could probably make more money doing a lot of other things, but you can't get that same adrenaline rush, you know, being on court, teaching a lesson to someone, that you can when you're coaching, you know, a Mitch Krueger, and he's playing the finals of a challenger in Cary, North Carolina. And you've invested so much of your time and energy and effort into trying to help him be the best player that he can be. And there's a bond that's created between player and coach, you know, in those environments. And you just want to see that come to fruition. And when it does, you know, I bring up that tournament, obviously, because you experienced that, you know, and seeing your guy win a tournament, you know, even at that level is a, an amazingly exhilarating experience, you know,
absolutely.
And you've been lucky enough and I've been lucky enough to see that at the Grand Slam level, you know, and we become super invested in what we're doing. And actually, if we're not, if your player's losing matches and it doesn't hurt, then you're not invested in the player enough. You know, it's gotta hurt when they lose. It's gotta be more than just the job. And that's what this job makes things into, more than just the job.
Exactly. I mean, I think there's so much to be said for it takes a team, you know. I think that's more evident now than ever. You see with the lineup that the players have, and there's even more people behind the scenes. And maybe that's something I'd like to touch on now, you know, kind of the injection of analytics that's kind of come in the last few years within tennis. How much has that influence, has that changed your method of coaching? Do you trust the eye? Do you trust the analysis? Or do you just continue to focus on Tommy's game and utilize the scouting? To what degree is Tommy bought into that? And yeah, where do you stand on the latest wave of I suppose, yeah, sport education and yeah, information.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, I think that, you know, I think that we're in an era of tennis right now. And I've been around for a long time. But I think we're in an era of tennis that has the greatest parity within the game that we've ever seen. You know, you look at the guys that are at the top of the game, and obviously Rafa and Roger have faded away. Novak, you know, is still playing amazing tennis despite the fact that he lost here, you know, a little bit early. But, you know, you look at the top players, you know, whether it's Alcaraz or Sinner or Medvedev or whoever it might be, and you see those guys much, much, much more often now being pushed in matches. They lose more sets than I think you used to see the top guys lose. They're pushed to three sets more often. They're pushed to five sets more often. They're losing matches more often. And,
yeah,
you know, part of that, maybe they're not, you know, they're not the GOATs like Roger and Rafa and Novak have been, and they're still developing. But I think a huge part of that is that the money has gotten so big now, and it should continue to get big, and it should continue to get bigger, I think. But it's gotten big to the point where virtually everybody can afford a team. Everybody has a team now. In the old days, you know, the guys that were ranked outside the top 50 or whatever, you know, back in the 90s, you didn't have a lot of guys that had teams. There were a lot of guys that they would have a coach, but they would only have the coach maybe come to the slams or maybe to a couple of the other bigger tournaments. Now you have guys that are traveling with full teams on a regular basis, you know, guys that are hiring their own physios more often. And the analytics part has become a big part of that. Obviously, analytics has been in the conversation now for a while, and it's become a big part of that. And guys can afford to have analytics on their teams. You know, the federations are using analytics and supporting their players with analytics more often. You know, I think that the Italians and the French, and we do within the U.S. when the guys aren't playing.
Same with the LGA, yeah,
American players. And I think the Australians, they were one of the, you know, first ones that did it really at a high level. And so, you know, these guys are getting a lot of information, good information, quality information that's helping them compete better on the court. And that's where we're seeing the parity within tennis. You know, you're seeing guys that are ranked 80 or 90 that are pushing the top guys. And we see that happening much, much, much more often, you know. And from our standpoint, you know, we started using an analytics company last year. We had access to the USTA analytics, and we still do. But we decided to go outside of that and use our own analytics team now that we use, and we get analytics before every match, you know, about 24 hours or sometimes 12 hours before Tommy's going to play someone. You know, we get information on them. I think also one of the best uses of analytics is, you know, what the term reverse scouting. So after the course of a period of time, maybe 3 to 4 tournaments, I'll ask the analytics guys to do a scouting report on Tommy, basically what everybody else would see on Tommy. And then sometimes maybe 2 or 3 times a year, I'll ask them to do an even deeper dive something that's a little bit more in depth as to, you know, where Tommy's making the majority of his errors, where's Tommy winning the majority of his points, and those kind of things. So we sat down, for example, in the off season, I sat down with our guy. He came down to my place because he lives in California also. And so he came down to my place and we hit a few balls for about an hour and then
got into the nitty gritty.
Yeah. He's about a 4 or 5 player. So he was super happy to come down and hit balls. And then we just sat down and having him go through all of the information and some different stuff there that we got a chance to look at. And that was definitely, I think that's almost as helpful as getting the pre-match scouting information is.
Yeah, I agree.
When I first approached Tommy about it, because I originally contacted them asking them for a very in-depth reverse scouting report. So basically scouting on Tommy, like, you know, just all the information on Tommy that I wanted from like the past 6 months to just look at it. And they kind of talked me into saying like, look, you know, here's the price for that. But if you'll commit to a full year, we'll give you a little discount and you can get that as often as you want. And then we'll do all this other stuff. And so I spoke to Tommy about it, and Tommy's very open, you know, and he just said, if you think it's going to be worthwhile, then let's do it. And I said, T, listen, if you win one more round at a Slam or a Masters 1000 because of the analytics, then it's going to pay for
itself.
Good
investment.
And it's a good investment. It'll be worth it. So we're doing it. And last off season, we started last year, right after the grass court season. With them, and in the off season, I asked Tommy, you know, how he felt and if he wanted to continue, if he felt there was value there for what he was paying for it and everything. And he said, absolutely. Analytics was something that he wanted to continue to use, you know, and in a lot of cases, Dave, it just solidifies. And I think Tommy is a pretty visual learner. So when he can see it, you know, I try not to overwhelm him with the data. I think most coaches say the same thing about that, you know, like, I get a lot more data and look at a lot more data than he does. But when he can look at it and see it right in front of him, I think it does clarify things for him about how he wants to play. That being said, listen, there's also times, and I'll give you a perfect example. Tommy played Roman Safulin first round of the US Open last year, absolute war of a match. He was down 2 sets to love. And, you know, deep into the second set, when he got down a break, I actually screamed at him from the sidelines to stop playing to the stats, because there were certain things in the stats that said, you know, you can play here. This is where he's weakest. This is, you know, different things like that. And Tommy was really, really focused on trying to play exactly what the stats were saying. And I dropped a few F-bombs,
superlatives,
screaming at him and said, hey, stop playing the stats and start playing your game. And in the end, you know, that's something that you have to be aware of. There can be a little bit of a danger there. And you have to, I think from our standpoint as coaches, we have to make sure that we're doing a good job of presenting that information, recognizing that the other player may have analytics as well. So they may be looking at things and they're going to be trying to counter what you're doing. Maybe they're getting reverse analytics. And so they're looking at it and saying like, oh, I know Tommy Paul is going to see my analytics and he's going to be like, oh, I should attack this spot in the court. So I'm going to try and make sure that I'm super aggressive from that position or whatever it might be, you know, to counter those things. And so it's a tool. It's a tool. But in the end, it comes down to the players still being able to produce their best tennis under pressure. And that's a completely different aspect. You can know exactly where the other guy's going to hit a ball. He could be wearing a sign on his forehead that says, hey, I'm serving to your forehand here. And you know, it doesn't matter if you're feeling the pressure under that moment and you can't execute the shot, the analytics don't make any difference.
Exactly. So yeah. It's a great resource.
Yes, 100%. You know, it's one thing I don't like about it, Dave. One thing I don't like about it, and I say this all the time, is that I think it makes, this is going to sound super cocky when I say this actually, but I think it makes coaches that aren't great coaches into better coaches. They coach to the analytics a lot. I do think that a good friend of mine, when I was coaching at the USTA, said one time when we were doing our national coaches meetings and there was a big presentation of some sports science stuff going on, and he's a Frenchman, so it was perfect coming from him. You know, he said that He said they want to make everything into science. They want to talk about the science, analytics the same way, you know, and they forget that coaching is actually an art form. And I think that that's something that's important, you know, how you present the analytics, you know, and being able to make sure that, like, yeah, okay, he may have tendencies in this area, but you can't rely on that all the time, and recognizing that. And I think that great coaching really is an art form, knowing when to be tough on your guy, when to pull back, when to apply pressure, when to reduce pressure. All those kind of things, all those aspects of coaching are a little bit more of an art form than they are a science, really. So that it's always interesting, because there's a lot of coaches, I think, especially, again, maybe at the lower level that are trying to come up, younger coaches that are using analytics more, but they forget about the presentation and how you connect with your player, how you make your player feel that everything that you're saying is you know, they have trust and belief in what you're presenting to them. You know, that's part of the art of being a coach, I think.
Totally. So obviously, fantastic week in Palm Springs so far. First semifinal for Tommy at a Masters. Am I right in saying that?
No, first semifinal here. He made semis in Canada last year.
Okay,
at a Masters 1000. Yeah. So
pardon me.
It's all right. You know,
extra sweet still, that it's on home soil. Obviously, yeah, in Montreal or Toronto last year was close to home, but a little close to home for you. I mean, this is probably your local event, so must be pretty special to see Tommy out there competing. Tough opponent. I actually just had a quick look there, and his head-to-head against Daniil is, played him twice before, lost on both occasions. Yeah, so looking ahead to the match, he's obviously got his own unique style. When we talked about style earlier in the conversation, he's definitely embracing his own idiosyncrasies and playing the game a different way, and it's, yeah, it's a challenge to face that. So what is Team Paul looking to try and do going into tomorrow's match in Indian Wells?
Yeah, it's not only is his record not particularly good, but if you look at the score from the last match, he basically got his ass kicked in
2-1 in Beijing. Yeah, I saw that.
2-1 was one of the worst beatings I've seen Tommy take, our team take in the whole time that I've been with Tommy. And Daniil, I mean, he creates some interesting and unique issues to try and deal with on court. Obviously, the return position is always, you know, trying to figure out what you do on that. Yeah, I mean, it is talked about so much because people are like, oh, you know, you have to serve him volley. Look how deep he is in the court. Yeah, well, you're right. But at the same time, he gets all day to see where you're coming and he can tee up the return from back there. You know, I think it's actually easier for a player from a deeper position in the court to dip the ball at your feet when you're coming forward. It's easier to create like sharp angles when you're returning from that deeper position. So, and he basically can put the ball on a dime from that return position. So it's not as easy to just say, oh, you got to serve him volley.
Swing him wide and come in.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if that was the case, a lot more people would beat him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So, and then on top of that, you've got the fact that he just is a brick wall from the back of the court. You know, I mean, you don't beat the wall very often, right? When you go and practice. And that's basically what it's like playing him. He just doesn't miss balls. I remember commentating a match of his in Australia, not this year, but the year before. And he was, almost two sets into the match. And I think he had like one or two winners in the whole. Basically, he was just playing the match, just saying like here, you know, if you can make more balls than I can, then you have a chance to win the match. But if you can't, you're going to lose. I guarantee you, because I'm never missing a ball. And that presents a tough situation for Tommy. You know, Tommy, we've built Tommy's game around being an all court attacking style player, and part of that is for him to come in and put more pressure. And the part of the basis for that is that Tommy's probably not as comfortable or patient as a lot of guys are from the back of the court. The way that guys play now. You know, he also doesn't possess the kind of power that someone like Sinner or Runa or Taylor Fritz does. He can't just beat balls by other guys. So he has to play tennis a little bit more, you know, if that makes sense. You know, he has to use the nuances of the game, the slice and changing pace and opening court and then looking to attack into those openings. And that's what we've really tried to create. He does that. He does mix in serve and volley. I think that's going to be super important. He has to do some of that, but I don't think you can do it every single time. And he has to try, and Danielle does a very good job of countering this, but he has to try and do a little bit of attacking off second serves, which has been really a key for this week of him doing that, something that we really reinforced and trying to get back to. It's something that we put into play with Tommy almost 2 years ago, really, was him. We call it the crush and rush. You know, you don't chip and charge anymore. And he's a two-hander, so he doesn't really chip and charge. But he's been taking the crush and rush and coming in behind that, you know. And it's put a lot of pressure on guys. And he's won a lot of points this week doing that. So he's got to try and find ways to shorten the points a little bit and put pressure on Danielle. Again, that being said, the brick wall becomes a very good passing wall when you come forward. Daniel plays, he plays well with a target and he's very good at passing. So it just creates a tough matchup for Tommy, without a doubt.
For most, really.
We'll look at the analytics a little bit and see if we can find anything there. But, you know, the one thing with Daniel is that you do recognize that if you keep the ball deep and you play through the court, he's not really looking to hit a lot of winners. So you can feel a little bit comfortable from that standpoint. You know, he's not absolutely ripping the cover off the ball like those other guys that I mentioned. So you can stay in the rallies. You can kind of, but you just have to try and find a way to win the rallies. And that's what's been tough for us in the past, you know, is that he's just outsteadied Tommy, you know, and that's been something that's been hard for Tommy to be able to deal with.
Well, there's no doubt Tommy's had a fairly electric start of the year, and we're wishing you guys all the very best tomorrow. I'm sure it'll be somewhat a light day ahead of you guys in Indian Wells. A little tickle you might get out there yourself, I'd say, Brad, would you?
No, we have a, you know, the Easter Bowl is going on at the same time, so we have a junior player that's going to come out, an American that won the doubles at the Aussie Juniors this year, so he's a good ball striker and
brilliant.
He's going to come out and play some with Tommy. Yeah.
A shame that Tommy's not giving you the call up, but I'm sure he's in good hands. Well, yeah, thanks so much for your time. I'm sure you've got to rush off now and get back to business. But wishing you and the whole team the very best. I'm sure there'll be great atmosphere for that encounter tomorrow night. And yeah, we look forward to watching, as most of the tennis world will.
Thanks, Dave. We appreciate it. Looking forward to having you back out here on tour so we can hit some balls.
Yeah, exactly. See you in Monte Carlo.
All right, perfect.
Cheers, Brad. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot.